You're listening to Faith-Based Mental Health, a weekly podcast designed to bridge the gap between spirituality and psychology.
Welcome to Faith-Based Mental Health. I am your host, Pastor Colt, and I'm here with my co-host, Dr. Ron. How are you today, Dr. Ron?
Good.
This would be the only time that I could actually say a man of few words, usually quite the opposite. And all of our listeners know that.
I was literally thinking through this before he came on. What's the most shocking thing I could say? I figured at this point, good.
That most likely, yeah, that probably is the most shocking thing you could say. You achieved it. You achieved it perfectly.
When my clients come on, I ask them the same question. And when they say good, I say, now, I'd like you to imagine for a moment that good had more adjectives attached to
it. Note to all parents, that's what you can use with your kids, especially when they're like middle school, they get home from school. How was your day? Good. There you go. Yeah. It's parents like, well, didn't know they were going to get a lesson today, but there it is.
There it is. And good sometimes day. I go, well, you might want to notify your face because your face doesn't think it was a good day.
That's a marriage tip right there. If your wife says good like that, that's exactly what you want to tell her. It will go over perfectly. Don't actually do that.
Speaking of your face being good, I can see from your face that it's been a good week.
Yeah, I would say it has. I don't know. I guess I'm a little bit giggly. It's been good.
Just, I guess, you know. I was specifically referring to the mustache. There's Carl crawling up there. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
It's been a good week.
It's... If anyone listening or watching us on YouTube is in the Air Force, then you will know what I'm talking about. It's an Air Force thing, and this reveals when we're recording this. It's called Mustache March. I cannot wait to get rid of it, but supposedly it boosts morale, so I have it right now.
And that's why you're good.
Yeah. So speaking of good, let's talk about some good methods to manage anxiety through managing your energy. I know that energy is going to play a large role in anxiety. And we talked about the same topic on depression, how your energy levels affect depression. And as I recall, in depression, your energy levels tend to be low. I think probably most people know that. So I imagine we're talking about an opposite scenario here. Within anxiety, your energy levels tend to be too high, and maybe that's some anxious energy. So Dr. Ron, what does that look like? Kind of just give us a broad scope for a second. What does that look like to manage anxiety with your energy levels?
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting, it's a little different. I know we talk about anxiety and depression being two sides of the same coin. With anxiety being excess mental or nervous energy, there sometimes when it's super acute, your heart can race, you begin to sweat, you know, everything that goes along with, you know, asking that girl out for the first time. But then that is often accompanied with a crash following. So it's not always this continual excited state, because you can only stay there for so long before the body crashes. So in depression, it's a pretty well constant, low, steady state of energy with spikes of, oh, I feel like I'm going to go do this. With anxiety, it's nervous energy with spikes of, I'm, you know, I got to check into a hotel and sleep for 2 days kind of thing. And so one of the most acute forms of this is when people have panic attacks. And what's a pretty common occurrence for the clientele that I get to be a part of is during the first 10 minutes of physical exercise, the heart will begin to pump up and the mind will say to them, oh, this is danger. And then the danger goes, whoa, they start going into these panic attacks. And I've even had several clients go to the hospital in the midst of what they thought was a heart attack, and it turned out to be anxiety related. And so for many folks, they mirror what they've learned a heart attack should feel like. So it's really, really frightening stuff. Definitely connected to physiology. And most of the treatment methods, at least in therapy, they don't specifically talk about that. Whereas most of the psychiatric methods, well, they don't necessarily talk about the other things. And so it's pretty cool for us to be able to have a conversation that we're able to dedicate an entire episode to the physiology. So I'm really excited about that. And I'm really excited about your opinion on some of the things as it relates to physiology and anxiety. So ready to get into it.
Amen. So you mentioned high blood pressure. You mentioned the physiological effects that anxiety can have on you. I want to go into that, but I want to wait. But I do know that anxiety can lead to an increase, and does in fact lead to an increase in blood pressure, which leads to all kinds of health risks, which is why things that can manage your anxiety from a energy management standpoint play together, and all of them help you to, in my opinion, not die at a young age. Because some of the things, and I'm going to list what I found. Let me know if there's anything to add. It's a short list. But some of the things that are going to help you to manage your anxiety from a energy management standpoint are exercise, super important, sleep, and eating well. To me, those are the obvious ones. Are we missing any?
Yes. The big one, medication.
I'll definitely ask some questions on that. That's much more an area of your expertise. And so I wouldn't have made sense that I brought the other three. So if you don't mind, I'd love to start with exercise, unless you've got another place you want to start.
I don't necessarily have another place I want to start, other than to offer the comment that in a future episode, we plan to really unroll a lot of the behaviors and the cognitions associated with treating anxiety. So some of the energy management things feel like cognitions and they feel like behaviors. And so I think that anyone, you know, listening will begin to be able to pick up some of these patterns. And so, yeah, if you notice that some of them fit into multiple lines of effort, then, you know, congratulations, because that's true. And so part of the conversation that you and I were having is, okay, there are all these interventions. What line of effort do they fit into? And they don't always fit in cleanly and neatly. So I imagine as we begin to talk about behaviors for reducing anxiety, we'll have to at least give honorable mention to sleeping and eating and exercise.
So with that, yeah, there is a connection between most of these ways that we manage anxiety. And I would say that's a good thing, because that kind of tells me that there's some key pieces I can do that we have discussed or will discuss in a future episode that are going to help me in other areas, like other ways of managing the anxiety as well. And so that's huge. I know exercise is one of the big ones for depression and anxiety. Let's go ahead and go there. Why does exercise matter so much for managing specifically anxiety?
It mirrors some of the physiological reactions of panic, especially in the first 10 minutes of cardiovascular fitness. And you can then condition your brain to where, okay, when my heartbeat starts to speed up, when I start to sweat, you can condition your brain to associate that with something positive as opposed to something negative. So the more repetitions you get in there, the more association there is with those physiological responses being positive as opposed to, oh my gosh, I'm having a heart attack. The irony of it is, it's very true that someone might be so worried that they have cancer that they could literally die from worry and never have cancer.
I have often read and heard that stress can kill you faster than most actual physical issues.
Yeah, and if you're like me, that really stresses me out.
That feels so defeating. To the listener, we've still been making comments like that, but that's true, and that's why we really need to manage these things. And of course, we've been using the word manage this whole time because we're not expecting you to all of a sudden be cured of whatever issue it is, whether it's the anxiety, the depression, or something else. But we do firmly believe that you can take correct steps in your life so that if your issue is anxiety, depression, or something else, you can take correct steps in your life so that the symptoms will be less, so that the difficulty will be less, and that your life will simply be better. And so that's the aim of what we're doing here.
Your faith gets stronger. Your connection with God gets stronger. It bleeds into all areas of your life. Anxiety reduction is more important than the lip service that we've given it in society. And so that which previously seemed like indulgences, we really need to begin to look at these things as medical necessities. And so I'm glad that we're able to change the conversation around stress and anxiety to begin to see it as important as it really is. For sure.
Absolutely. Amen. Amen. And so we talked about briefly on exercise and why that's important. And you mentioned that as you exercise, it teaches your brain that feeling of the increased heart rate, increased blood pressure, all that, it's not going to kill you. And so it's not a threat like your brain may have been previously telling you it was. Another piece that I believe it's doing is it's getting you into better shape. I mean, that's pretty obvious, right? And as you do that, as you get into better shape, and everybody knows this, your resting heart rate becomes lower and lower and lower over time. Your blood pressure should improve. Granted, the diet's huge for that too, the blood pressure especially, but we're going to get to that in a minute. Your blood pressure should improve. And anxiety throws your heart rate and your blood pressure through the roof. Exercise is going to manage that blood pressure and heart rate. And so when I said earlier, it's going to decrease the chances of you dying young, I mean that literally. Mm-hmm. Anxiety can, according to a little bit of information I read, anxiety can lead to heart attack and stroke and all kinds of other physical issues. And so it's extremely important to manage this well, especially from the physical side.
Yeah. And there's an added bonus, which is why I think that I don't have science behind this. I just have anecdotal experience with my clients that it's the first 10 to 15 minutes of working out that really has the greatest potential for panic and anxiety, because I think at some point you begin to have the dopamine release that comes with exercising that sort of replaces some of that. Some people have called it runner's high, things like that. Runner's high doesn't come in the first mile. I mean, I don't consider myself a runner. You probably have more experience with that. When I did run, I remember getting about 4 miles into the run and going, okay, yeah, I feel good, you know. But it takes a little while, which is why it's cool for us to talk ourselves through the anxiety at the beginning, knowing this too shall pass and we'll be able to get to some of those good chemicals as opposed to some of those anxiety producing chemicals. Yeah.
And I think the this too shall pass piece is extremely important, because when I'm feeling anxious about something, as I continue on through it, whether it's a run, something physical like that, or whether it's, I don't know, when I think back to college, a presentation coming up, I still do presentations today. Of course, I preach sermons as well. But something public like that, getting in front of people, that makes a lot of people anxious, nervous, all those things. I have found that I get better as I keep going. My wife told me this early in my position as a pastor when I had first started preaching on a regular weekly basis. And I think I've gotten better at this, but my wife told me very early on, your first 2 minutes are the worst part of the sermon. And she said, because I can hear a difference in your voice, and then your voice levels out and I can tell everything has changed after just a few minutes of preaching. And I think that was anxiety.
Maybe you should preach the first 2 minutes in the office.
There you go. There you
and
go.
And then come out and deliver the rest.
Right. Somebody will walk by and be like, what is he doing?
I think you're right, too. Public speaking is the number one phobia in America, followed by death.
Right.
So the joke is, at any given funeral, I'd rather be the guy in the casket than the guy giving the eulogy.
If you ask someone to deliver a speech and they say, I'd rather die, they mean it.
Yeah, right. When you rank phobias in America, that's kind of the irony of it. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember reading that in a public speaking book when I was like 15. And so that statistic has been around a long time and continues to ring true. I'm not 15 anymore. And so, yeah, it's people are terrified of it. So exercise is going to teach your brain and your body that, hey, this is okay. And even that there's going to be a dopamine release. And so there's going to be a reward. So it's going to get me somewhere I want to go. So very good. There's no stick now. It's just a carrot, like this positive reinforcement. So that's extremely powerful to our brains. And then the other piece is exercise is going to lower that blood pressure, resting blood pressure and heart rate, and make me healthier, which is going to decrease the negative side effects of the anxiety, because anxiety wants to throw your blood pressure and heart rate up. So again, exercise, huge. If you don't mind, the next one we talked about was sleep. And so what role does sleep play in managing my anxiety?
Oh, it's critical. I just got through a two-day continuing education class on managing suicide risk in individuals. And the latest science on suicides and how can we predict? This is the most important part of suicide intervention. How can we predict suicidal behavior in stressed people? And the number one predictor was insomnia. So the levels of insomnia that a person has is a direct correlation to their risk of death by suicide. And so that's, I mean, it's huge. Having the REM cycle, that sleep cycle, it resets so much in our brains. The dream state is our body trying to make sense of the things that didn't necessarily make sense during the day. So our brain's organized. Oftentimes, I'll be working on a complex problem set, whether that's an equation or a construction project or a piece of composition, and I won't have the answer to it. And I'll tell myself, sleep on it. And I'll wake up and it'll be one of the first thoughts that pop into my head. Bing, I've got the solution. And I didn't put any effort into it but sleep, because my brain is more powerful than I give it credit for. When I was at my lowest mentally was also when I was getting the worst amount of sleep, the worst quality of sleep in my life. So from an energy management perspective, you really have no energy to manage without sleep. That's how important it is.
And so I guess the expression, when somebody asks you a question and they say, I don't know, let me sleep on it, they're not just necessarily delaying. I mean, that actually makes a difference.
Oh, it's so wise. That's some of these pithy sayings, we don't realize how wise they are. Okay, I have some advice. I normally don't give advice. I normally just talk to people and I repeat back what they say. But my advice is, if there's something that's really important to you, type it up in an email and don't push send. Wake up the next day, read that email, and if you don't sound neurotic, then you can send it at that point. Some of the emails that I regret the most were sent at 2 a.m. The tone was all off, like, oh, why'd I push send? I know better. So if you're really stressed about something, yeah, sleep on it. Wake up. You'll have a fresh new perspective on it. Even for, like, I use this for my own mental health. On days where things are going terrible, I tell myself, you know what? Tomorrow's a brand new day. This is a problem for today. And I hit the reset button through sleep. So, yep, sleep management, anxiety management, hand in hand.
Amen. And if you're a bit younger and you're like, yeah, I actually never send emails except once in a while for work. And maybe your job doesn't really require that. Same thing applies to text messages. If it's a really important moment, and you know, if it's a phone call or a face-to-face interaction, writing it out would still be a good thing, and then sleep on it. And take a look at it the next day, and you're much less likely to experience that regret that Dr. Ron talked about.
You bring up a good point there. And I think it's something, if I had a dollar for every time I've said this on this podcast, I could probably put a down payment on something. It would be helpful for us to bring in some younger people There was a report that came out this week in the news saying that America is no longer in the top 20 of happiest nations on earth. And the reason why is because young people are reporting that their mental health is in the dumps. And so I would really be curious as to the perspective of young people on some of these mental health questions. So for future.
Absolutely, for a future episode. And I'm not sure if I should be offended or what, but I'm pretty sure I just got taken out of the category of young people I feel terrible about. I had the same experience recently. I was looking at groups for an event, and one of the groups was young adult, and it had an age range. And I was like, what the heck? Because it was really just like 20 to 30. And I was like, don't do that to me. Don't do that to me.
So here's the test. If you wonder if you're young, here's the test. After the podcast, when you stand up, do you groan?
I don't.
Okay, you're still young then.
My knees crack.
But like, oh, you're not young then. If there's any noise that comes out of your body involuntarily upon standing, then you probably don't fit the category of the youth demographic we're trying to inquire within.
There you go. And to the listener, you can ask, you know, when you, if you're listening in the car or whatnot, or sitting down, when you get up and you get out of that car, you can check on the same thing and you can be just as annoyed and upset with Dr. Ron as I am right now. Don't like hearing that truth. So sleep is going to make a huge impact, not just at the level of anxiety, but you really shocked me with that statistic about it being the number one indicator of suicide. That's, shocking and amazing and terrible. I know I have heard, and tell me if you agree with this, I have heard that everyone's different, I suppose, but for most people, 7 or more hours of sleep a night is what's recommended. Is that what you would find to be true?
Mm-hmm. There really is a sweet spot. For most people, you really don't want to get much more than 9. Mm. It begins to lose its effectiveness. But there really is a sweet spot. For me, it's 8. Just a little under, actually. It's probably about 10 to 15 minutes under 8. I wake up naturally without an alarm clock at that amount of time. That's another test to know, are you getting enough sleep? If you have to be up at 7 and you can do it without an alarm clock, then you're probably getting enough sleep. But if you sleep through 4 or 5 alarms, here's your sign.
I feel attacked. I feel very, very attacked on sleep. You know, this is just me being honest and vulnerable on sleep. This is one where I have to just more so talk to you about what I have read and what I have learned as opposed to what I've experienced. Sometimes I do well in this area. I think I've mentioned this before. And sometimes I don't. With a newborn, I don't do as well as I used to. But it's important, and because not only does exercise help in the whole lowering normal average blood pressure and heart rate. But if you Google what are the side effects, at least I think Google would tell you this. It should. Research this and you'll find it eventually, hopefully pretty quickly. Probably top results. What are the negative side effects of a lack of sleep? You are going to find increased blood pressure, increased normal blood pressure. And so again, it's another factor that's trying to kill you if you do it wrong. So this is pretty big stuff.
You really want to see something horrifying about this? Hmm. Research the experiments done by the Russian government on sleep, sleep deprivation. It's horrifying. It's the stuff of nightmares. It's so terrible. I can't even on this podcast say, but the end result is that if you deprive a man of sleep long enough, he will turn to self-cannibalism as a coping mechanism.
This is the moment where I remind Dr. Ron that this is an episode on anxiety, and some people experience anxiety and feel anxious as they're trying to sleep at night.
You have to sleep. If you don't.
Yes. Oh, gosh. Do not think about that as you sleep tonight, please, for the love of God. Do not do that. for the sake of transparency, I'm not going to cut that out. But my goodness, don't think about that as you're trying to sleep tonight. And actually, I wanted to talk about that. So that's a good accidental segue. If I'm trying to sleep at night, Dr. Ron, I don't know if you've seen anything with this or have any recommendations, but and I am feeling anxious. Maybe it's about something that's going to happen tomorrow.
I'm sorry. Or
maybe it's about cannibalism.
I thought you were going to transition to the nutrition and eating section of this.
I wasn't. No. No, because
I thought, well, that brings up a good point. We were going to talk about food. I had a hard time focusing on where we were going because that was the mental image I had in my mind. I apologize for derailing the entire podcast, you were saying, sir.
Cannibalism is not the right moment to transition into talking about proper diet.
Dr. Wherever Robert, you're at you. Right now.
We are just going to pray for you.
Whether you're driving in the car or listening to this while exercising, if you hear nothing else from this podcast, remember, self-cannibalism is not the answer to whatever problems you may be facing. Yeah.
And if you really needed to hear that right now, because that's where you're at, do me a favor. Go to serenitycarecounseling.com and schedule a session like as soon as possible. We will make the time for you.
For free.
Yeah. It needs to happen. It needs to happen.
We're saving lives one bite at a time. I'm done. I'm out. I'm laughing too hard.
So, Dr. Ron, before you started laughing hysterically and making me laugh hysterically to the point where we lost all composure and maybe had to cut out a quick segment. If you're watching, that's why all of a sudden Dr. Ron doesn't have his hoodie or jacket or fleece on, whatever that was.
I laughed so hard I got hot and had to take it off. That's terrible.
Yeah, he had to manage the temperature. Mm-hmm. I was going to ask you if you had any practical advice for if I'm trying to sleep at night and I do feel anxious about something, because a lot of times that anxiety, this thought's racing through my mind and I'm nervous, I'm worried, you know, all these words that lead into anxiety and I can't sleep. Any thoughts on what I could do right then? Because if I tell myself, Cole, just stop thinking about it, that's not going to work.
Well, if I may, I'd like to give you some quick tips on sleep hygiene for reducing anxiety from an energy management perspective. These are just going to be the highlights because I really believe the issue is so important. We should probably do an entire episode on sleep management. The bottom line is you can download an app. The Department of Defense and the VA. The VA makes something called CBTI Coach, which stands for Cognitive Behavioral Therapy for Insomnia Coach. And I'll summarize the highlights for it. Just like with nutrition, the key to preventing anxiety from a nutrition perspective is the reduction of stimulants. The same is true for sleeping. So the key thing is we want to wake up at the same time every day, Monday through Sunday, same time every day. And only go to bed when you're feeling sleepy. And sleepy is differentiated from tired. So the time that you go to bed tired, you can be physically tired, but sleepy is the chemicals in your brain that induce sleep are firing off. So now we can go to bed. Some people might have experience, for example, with being so tired that they can't sleep. Tired and sleepiness are differentiated here. So if you're not sleepy, within 15 minutes, if you can't fall asleep, you should get up, get out of bed, go somewhere else, do something else. The other thing is, and the idea that your bed should be reserved for only two activities, one of which is sleep, and they both start with S.
I think we can guess the other one.
Right.
We're talking to the married crowd here.
Right. Because what we want to do is have the bed, the physical location of the bed, be associated with those activities and those activities alone. If we're reading in bed, if we're watching television in bed, if we're solving the world's problems, if we're doing Sudoku, then essentially we are associating the bed with a place where we're supposed to be mentally stimulated. And the challenge with anxiety is that you're already overly mentally stimulated. So those are the wave tops. Reducing the stimulants, which we're going to get into next from a nutrition perspective, but also reducing the stimulants in terms of a behavioral perspective, blue light going on in from your cell phone, et cetera, et cetera. In fact, people who have the highest success with sleep management, they put their cell phone somewhere else other than the nightstand. So physically requires them to get up out of bed when the thing goes off at the same time every single day, whether you want to or not. And that's kind of one of the keys for reducing insomnia and increasing, and the key word that they use in treating insomnia is efficacy. We're not trying to make you sleep forever. What we want you to do is sleep effectively. Those are some of the wave tops that we'll probably get into in a later episode, a full episode on sleep.
And so I want to point one of those out and just emphasize it real quick, because I know a lot of people are doing – well, I'll point out two. A lot of people are doing these two wrong. Number one, if you're trying to sleep better, you should probably take the TV out of your bedroom, off of the wall, just out entirely. That's one that my wife and I found to be the case earlier in our marriage. We had a TV in our room because that's just what everybody does. And very quickly, I mean, within about a week or two, we realized we were sleeping less immediately, and it was significant. And we don't even really, we're not the type to watch a lot of TV, but that just made it too easy for us to watch TV. And so I very quickly told her, hey, I think we need to take this down. And we kind of talked about it for a while and decided together, yes, it's got to go. The other piece is whatever percentage it is of people that have a TV in their room, the percentage of people who have a phone on the nightstand or in their hand is way higher. And so that phone, I'm not saying don't use it as an alarm, but don't use it as anything else before bed. And so probably the most practical thing you could do to get a little bit or maybe even a lot better sleep tonight is go buy yourself an alarm clock right now and put your phone in the next room over, or maybe even just across the room, and use that alarm clock and see how much better your sleep is a week from now.
And there's so many more. I mean, I really could talk all day about this particular
issue. I wrote it down. We will do an episode on sleep, at least
one. It's just too important. It's too important not to. Yeah. And then managing energy from a nutrition perspective is eating healthy, the bottom line. But then there are certain types of food that lend themselves toward energy reductions and certain types of food that lend themselves toward energy increasing. And we kind of intuitively know these things. People who abuse caffeine often do it as a self-medication to give them some energy to deal with depression. And so if I'm dealing with anxiety, the last thing I want is to be jittery. Oh, that's gonna really mess me up. So reducing all of the stimulants. Sugar is a big one. Caffeine is a big one. Salt is a big one. If you reduce and or eliminate these things from your diet to the extent that you're capable and able to, you should experience physiological symptom reduction when it comes to anxiety.
Yeah, I've got some personal experience with one of those pieces. I don't say this to brag. I say this because it's a fact and it's relevant, and I think it's a good example. I quit added sugars about 8 months ago now, and there are some exceptions. I don't want to pay the money that it takes to buy bread that has no added sugar. So the bread I buy has like 1 gram. But besides that, I have not taken in added sugar, with the exception of bread and with the exception of this past Thanksgiving. I have not taken in added sugar in the past 8 months. And it was a really funny thing. I know what my normal blood pressure is because I used to be a combat medic in the Army when I was younger. And so I would check that kind of thing pretty often. My normal was about 130, mid-130s over 70 to mid-70s, somewhat high for a young person. I checked it about a month and a half ago, and I checked it multiple times because I didn't believe the result. And I actually had a medical professional checking it, and I asked her to check it multiple times. My average in those multiple times that we checked it was 106 over 62.
Oh.
Incredible drop. We're talking from like 135 to over 75 to 106 over 62. An incredible drop. You almost don't want to drop any lower. And my average resting heart rate has also gone down quite a bit. And so I'm not someone who struggles as much with anxiety, I don't think. But what I do know is I just did my heart a huge favor. And I use that as an example just to say, if you make some of these nutritional adjustments, your physiology will improve, your physiology will improve. And with that, anxiety won't hit as hard. If you've got lower blood pressure, lower heart rate, anxiety won't hit as hard. And so, yeah, the eating part, huge. I did not increase my exercise at all in that time. I want to be clear. I still exercise not near enough, just like I was doing before I quit sugar. So yeah, it's a big piece.
For sure. And that piece kind of leads us to the final topic. And I don't know how much time that this topic's going to take. So we'll talk it through. And if we need to splice and dice our episodes, we'll do that. It's a controversial topic. And so from the offset, let me just be clear that there are a variety of opinions on this particular topic. And I have mine, and I'm sure Pastor Colt has his. And they are just that. They are opinions. And you are entitled to your opinion on this. I'm really curious, Pastor Colt, what you've learned and discovered about the theology surrounding this next topic. And that's the idea of anxiety reduction through energy management utilizing chemicals to reduce our anxiety and our excess nervous energy. So these things have been around for quite some time now. Some of the oldest psychotropics and things are directed at anxiety reduction. So you've got your Xanaxes, you've got your Prozacs. And then, you know, there are new generation 2, generation 3 medications, Lexapro and so on and so forth, that are aimed at reducing anxiety. And so my opinion, I mean, this is the podcast. This is what we do. We give our opinion, right? My opinion is that if you're driving along in your car and the antifreeze is messed up, maybe you should just get that chemical composition fixed so you don't overheat your car. You know, and if your car is just, it just naturally eats through antifreeze and you have to replace those chemicals more often than not, then that's the car that you have. And so if you want to drive it, you should probably make sure that these chemicals, oil, and I think the human body is similar. I think that in America, these are my opinions. Oftentimes we rush toward medication in ways that are unhealthy. So I am not the guy that says everyone needs to go out and get on medication, but I'm also not the guy who says that medication is wrong or sinful. I think it has a place. Now, part of the reason why we run toward it is because we've created specializations in the psychological field. So me, for example, I am a therapist. I cannot prescribe you a medicine. And so what happens is that the people who can prescribe you medication, they end up, that becomes their niche. And so it's like if Colt were a psychiatrist, for example, and my therapist tells me I should go to a psychiatrist, well, the psychiatrist, I mean, this is what they do. They manage medications. Or a psychiatrist nurse is the same way. And so if that's the only provider you've gone to and you wonder why they keep pushing medications on you, well, that's their specialty. That's their job. And unfortunately, a lot of people don't know the difference between a psychologist and a psychiatrist. They just want help. and they go to the doctor because that's what they know they do. If I'm sick, I go to the doctor. And then the doctor refers them to a psychiatrist. And the next thing they know, they go, I'm against medication because every time I go out for help, everyone just wants to push pills on me. So I think it's important to understand the different lanes and the different specializations. But I have clients from all over the world, and my European counterparts will tell me that you Americans, you're all on drugs. And they might be onto something there. I don't really know what their medical system looks like compared to ours, but that seems to be the case. I'm wondering, from your perspective, I know the Bible doesn't come out and say, you know, take Xanax, but what do you think the Bible has to say about all these things?
I'm going to jump into that in just a moment. First, I have to take this rare opportunity, because I do believe you just said psychiatrist, nurse.
Yeah.
And I believe it's a psychiatric nurse.
Thank you.
And so I get this rare moment for the listener. Some of you may know, some of you may not know. I've known Dr. Ron a very long time, and he has a very extensive vocabulary. That's probably the first time in several years, if ever, that I've ever corrected him on something he said. So
Thank you.
On a high right now, a natural one, by the way, and it feels good. Feels good. There tends to be two camps of thought here, two schools of thought. One which says, do not do anything that is not natural to the way that God created you. And that side would say, don't dye your hair. Don't wear too much makeup. Don't do all of these things. And if you're of a denomination that really discourages, I'm not trying to come against you. I'm just telling you, this is kind of the one extreme side. And I guess maybe one group that this plays out on is Amish. And we might very well not have any Amish listeners, because typically Amish aren't going to listen to a podcast. But I love Amish people. Grew up around a lot of them. But they won't do any of these things, and definitely would not be fans of medicating for psychological things, because it's the idea of, if God didn't make me with that in me, I'm not doing it. Even if it's something that is in you, you just need an increase. It's this idea of, it's not natural to God's creation and his order. I will not do it. The other school of thought that is kind of the opposite extreme is that God made everything. And so even the drugs that we've had to put together, different medical compounds to create, like obviously marijuana, well, he pretty straight up made that. However, other drugs just made the compounds. He still made the compounds. We put them together. But it's okay. God made it. You know, the whole God made the dirt so the dirt won't hurt concept extended to literally everything. I think a healthy perspective lies somewhere in between. And where you are on that slider between those two things, I don't know. And I'll honestly say I don't know where the right spot is for sure. But the right spot is definitely in between those two extremes. My perspective has changed over time. When I was younger, it was more so the don't mess with it at all. Even though, as I said on a previous episode, I started drinking coffee when I was 8. I'm kind of like that guy you were counseling who had the huge monster container and said, I don't do medication. Yeah, that was me, I guess, as like a kid. As I've got older and I've seen the difference that medication can make in people's lives in this area and in different mental health areas, I think I would be very mistaken if I tried to deny its usefulness. So to answer your question quite simply, Dr. Ron, I would say it's somewhere between those two extremes. I can't tell the listener exactly where they should fall, but if they're in either one of those extremes, I think they really need to question where they're at and ask themselves why, and to examine that.
Yeah, just like we talked about with medication and depression, they fall into two camps. So depressive medicine often is somewhat of an upper. It gives you some of that energy that you need, but it doesn't matter if you're not making the life choices that you need to make. That energy should empower you to make positive life choices. And so when people are super anxious, it takes up all of their emotional energy. There's nothing, I mean, it's right there. It's the forever now. Anxious people are horrible, like, planners, you know. Well, it's not even the forever now. It's the forever tomorrow, the forever this thing bad is about to happen. They can't think about the other things that they need to do cognitively, behaviorally, spiritually. And so their medication tends to be more of a, let me bring the nervous energy down. Depression medication is often taken in the morning. Anxiety medication often taken at night. It has a tranquilizing effect. But again, if you're just tranquilizing for the sake of tranquilizing and not reinvesting now that you have mental clarity on the life changes that are actually going to produce an unanxious presence in yourself and in the people that you interact with, then all you're doing is just taking drugs. And the two most common drugs taken for anxiety are probably some of the least effective ones. Alcohol, marijuana. Everybody knows that alcohol is a downer. If you take too much, what happens? You don't run a marathon, right? You pass out. You know? The problem with them is their ineffectiveness can also be tied to their short-term effectiveness. They are in the very, very, very short term. You forget about your problems because you're drunk. But then as soon as that's over, now you're hungover and your problems are doubled. And that's why alcohol is so addicting, because it's this spike downward in anxiety followed by an extreme spike upwards that leads you to go, oh no, how do I make it go down? Well, that worked yesterday, you know, and you drink again and you start this cycle. And same thing with marijuana. It's not an extended release medication yet. There's a lot of research going into this stuff, by the way. Things that would get you locked up for life 10 years ago are now the government is investing money into figuring out, well, how do we make the benefits of this more of an extended release capacity? And there's studies with veterans, with PTSD. What's the best method of treating that and reducing the social anxiety within veterans who struggle with this? I don't know all the answers, but I know that it's more complex than what some people who are quick to dismiss give it credence. From an energy management perspective, this is the place and the time that we talk about medication. And my perspective is, if the barn needs painting, put some paint on the barn. And if the chemicals need to be adjusted, adjust the chemicals. If your bone were broken and your leg were at a weird backwards 90 degree thing, and you needed to put a metal pipe in your leg to straighten it out, you would do that probably without asking. Well, if your chemicals are crooked and twisted in a way that need to be ironed out, the medicine is there for a reason. If I had to summarize it, it would be this. Anti-anxiety medication is not the be-all and end-all. It can, however, in a short term, help you to make the life changes that you need to. It has a waning efficacy that most often goes away after about 2 years or so. And so you have to have it reevaluated every 2 years to see if it's being effective or not. But those life changes that you made and that you stuck to, they last forever.
Amen. Amen. So yeah, I'm hearing this principle, and you talked about it once before when you, in an episode where you did talk about when you got on some medication to manage some things. And the principle is that a lot of people who are against medication at all cost for mental health issues need to open themselves up a little bit to the potential that it can be useful, and that should you get on it, while you are on it, you need to begin taking the newfound strength that you have. Maybe it's the calm nature that you have now that you have come down from some of that anxiety. You need to take that newfound ability and begin to do the things you can do to manage the anxiety, which will assist the medication. And maybe eventually that means you get off of it. Maybe it doesn't. But either way, you now have the ability to make the changes you need to make to lead a better life. And so it's time to begin making those changes at that point, which are assisted by that medication.
And then the flip side of that conversation is, that if you are struggling with anxiety and you're waiting for that doctor's appointment to fix all of your problems, maybe you're putting a little too much hope on that medication. So balance is important.
Amen. Speaking of balance, this is probably a good time for us to go ahead and finish. This is our longest episode to date. And I know some podcasts that maybe the listener listens to are quite longer than this, so hopefully it's not too much. But I think at this point, I'm going to go ahead and say, if you need anything further, if what you've heard has sparked something inside of you and you're like, you know what, I have been struggling with this, please be sure to check us out on serenitycarecounseling.com and take a look at the resources we have there. Also, take a look at perhaps an opportunity to talk to a counselor or a life coach if that's what you need in order to help you manage your anxiety. Otherwise, thank you so much for listening. If you got something out of this, tell a friend about the podcast, or if you're on our YouTube channel, which, by the way, is Faith-Based Mental Health, if you haven't looked it up yet. If you're on our YouTube channel, tell a friend about it. Tell them to go watch it. Send them a link if you think it would be helpful. Thank you for being here, Dr. Ron. Thank you for everything you provided today, as always, and we will see you next time.
Aloha.